Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to the Rouleur podcast. I'm Ian Parkinson. Well, this edition was due to be a celebration of the classics and monuments season so far, in particular a fine edition of Paris-Roubaix with a hard-fought victory by a worthy winner. Then, of course, we woke up the day after the race to have confirmed the news that many of us had gone to sleep dreading. 23-year-old Michael Gerlitz, a rider for the Verandas Williams Crelan team, had died after a seemingly routine crash in the peloton on the second set of cobbles. Well, the author and commentator, Ned Bolting, is with me. Ned, first of all, fatalities in pro cycling are relatively rare, but it's still a ghastly business, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's a reminder that we are flesh and blood. Road racing in particular belongs on that spectrum of human activity, which is inherently dangerous, risk, you know, and that's, I'm afraid that forever will be part of its appeal. On a day like this, it's very hard to face up to that truth, but it is. You know, you go to the circus to see the trapeze artist and the high wire act, and you don't want to see a safety net. It takes the edge off the experience. And I don't know whether we will ever kind of resolve that internal conflict within road racing. The fact of the matter is that cycling and a family are now mourning the loss of a 23-year-old son. You know, he's not a rider I knew much about. The name was familiar to me, but little more than that. I did notice him for the first time as a racer just last weekend.
In the Tour of Flanders?
In the Tour of Flanders, where he's in the breakaway. Probably his biggest day out on a bike. He came from the east of Belgium, was brought up in those kind of like cycling heartlands where Philippe Gilbert comes from, actually, right over towards the south of Antwerp. He was picked up briefly by Lotto Soudal and was a stagiaire with Lotto Soudal a couple of years ago in 2016 in the same intake that Lotto Soudal picked up James Smith. And he did okay for them, you know. He got a couple of victories. One race in particular, a race that doesn't feature as a kind of professional victory because it's a level below that in Belgium, but nonetheless a brutally hard race to win, called Brussels Zeppelin. He won attacking 75 kilometres out on a day when it was snowy and it hailed. He was one of them, you know, he was Belgian through and through. He could win from a small group. He was big, a hard man. If you look at his results over this early season of 2018, leading up to this, his death in Paris-Roubaix, he was in the break in the Tour of Flanders. He finished 20th in Kerner-Brussels-Kerner. And ninth in the top 10 in Dwars door West Vlaanderen. And, you know, that suggests that he had a great future ahead of him.
As you say, the danger and the risk of pro cycling is, you know, no one, or very few people, want to see crashes. But surviving the risks is part of the appeal.
Well, but there is, I mean, there is perhaps something that we can take from this, I think, as a wider cycling community. And with the benefit of hindsight, it's easy, but I genuinely, in the day or so before Paris-Roubaix this year, was starting to become uneasy with the online fetishization of the potential for a wet race. You know, there's this yearned for idea that Paris-Roubaix is a better spectacle when it's wet. I understand that, you know, to some extent. I also wanted to see a wet race. But I think we should all just kind of back off that a little bit, take a step back and appreciate that, you know, it's a dangerous race. Don't make it more dangerous, I don't think. You know, you don't, for example, on the Tour de France, you don't pray for an icy and treacherous descent, do you? You don't do that. You know, you want the race to be as safe as it can be, and yet, as we've touched on right at the beginning, it's a dangerous sport.
So aside from that awful news, it was actually a great race.
And it always is. It always is. It's my favourite race on the calendar. I'm not alone in that regard, I don't think. I think it has more ebb and flow and more nuance and more intrigue than even the Tour of Flanders. I mean, I have a personal preference for Paris-Roubaix over the Tour of Flanders because Flanders does have its, you know, it has its Quaremont, it has its launch pad, it has its clear, defined places where the expected moves will happen. And yes, Paris-Roubaix has the Carrefour d'Arbre, and of course it has the Arenberg Trench, and those are the two kind of, you know, the things that you highlight. But you know, in it, time and time again, you see the race develop in between phases. You never quite know when it's going to happen, and you know, often it is defined by crashes that can come out of the blue. You know, I think that the size or the relative small size of the group that was eventually left trying to chase down Peter Sagan was in some length, to some extent at least, dictated by the crashes along the way. And that's a part of it. But it's just a fascinating race. I mean, it's just, there are so many, what impressed me about Sagan on this particular occasion, there's so many infinitely variable ways of losing that race. And very few ways of winning it, you know. And to get hit the right formula on the right day and back it up with the physical strength that he did, was great to watch. I know I thoroughly enjoyed it. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
And wearing the world champions jersey as well.
Yeah, helps, doesn't it?
A word also about Sylvain Dillier, who put in an extraordinary performance. And, you know, could you get Peter Sagan on your wheel, then you're probably thinking about second place. But yeah, he could have won.
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, no one was talking about Sylvain Dillier's potential in Paris-Roubaix. I mean, literally no one, except perhaps Sylvain Dillier. I don't think he wasn't on anyone's radar. He came up with a fantastic quote. I was just reading about late last night, or was it early this morning, where he was talking to Peter Sagan in a tweet, and he said, "You are an angel and a devil in one person," which I think is just, I'd be so proud of if I came up with that. But that, you know, he's in a beautifully wrought phrase, he has summed up the both the honour, the triumph, and the despair of the situation in which he was cast. You know, I have to work with this beast of a rider in order to hold on to my second position, but that's all it's going to be. But you're absolutely right. There would have been a moment where Sagan was going, "Hang on, I haven't shaken him off. And what can he do to me on the track? I will have to be absolutely on it on that track to get the better of Dillier." And he did. He did, Sagan. He got the better of him. But it was interesting. I mean, you saw them conversing once or twice in the final 10 kilometres when it was clear that after a kind of 10 or 15 minute block of effort, when that chase group, the Terpstra Van Avermaet group, was working, you know, through and off, and they definitely kind of became a team, clawed back 5 painful seconds that became 10 painful seconds, but then they stalled. And then they realised that, all right, then they started finessing their own battle for third place, didn't they? So from that moment on, then you saw this conversation going on between Dillier and Sagan. And I think the conversation probably was something along the lines of, you know, Sagan said, "How far are we going to take this?" And I think they both said, "Let's take it to the track." And then may the best man win, you know. And it's great. I'm trying to think the last Paris-Roubaix that came down to two men entering the velodrome. And I mean, Cancellara and Sepp van Marke springs to mind, where Cancellara completely, tactically murdered the faster man on the track. You know, that was Sepp van Marke's all day long. He's a track specialist. He's got the sprint on him. And Cancellara just got inside his head, you know, by virtually coming to a standstill and teasing him onto the front. Yeah, every race should end in a velodrome, shouldn't it? I mean, we're here at Herne Hill Velodrome, and I've been banging on for as long as I can remember to the Tour of Britain organisers to bring a race into here. I'd love to see a race finish here.
Love to see the whole pack trying to get through that narrow entrance, though.
Well, you'd have to string it out a bit, wouldn't you? You'd have to be a few times over Gypsy Hill before they sort of drop down into the velodrome. Bit of a South London thing, that. Sorry for those of you who don't know South London geography.
But looking at the classics and monument season as a whole, it's been a pretty good year.
Been fantastic, especially if you wear the blue of Quickstep. Extraordinary to watch that kind of spread out from their classics team, this wave of success within their team, and then spread to the Basque country and beyond. You know, so this, all of a sudden Enric Mas starts winning and Alaphilippe can't stop winning, and you know, and on and on and on it goes. And then the emerging riders Fabio Jakobsen and Hodeg, or Hodge, as we can choose which way to say him. You know, these are names to conjure with for the future, and yet their established stars are still doing it. And the only rider, really, to be disappointed from their ranks, I think, is Philippe Gilbert at the end of it all. Okay, he's still got the Ardennes Classics to come good, and maybe he will. It's been tremendous. It's been really, really, really good to watch. But it kind of always is, isn't it? It's one of the great blocks of racing in the calendar.
Been interesting actually to see how sort of newer fans, if you like, are now becoming more interested in the classics, having probably been attracted by some of the grand tours. Actually, that there's much more interest now, much more public interest now in some of the earlier races.
Yeah, I guess there is. It's still, I think it's we're some way off kind of breaking through into the wider sporting consciousness in the UK environment, in terms of, I think it's still a cycling insider thing to a large extent. Whether or not, I mean, I think a British victory at Paris-Roubaix might help. Can't see it coming anytime soon. I must say, they seem to be, you know, Luke Rowe was again unfortunate, but they seem to be, that, you know, the Stannard, Rowe, Thomas generation seem to be further away rather than closer. Now, so it might be over to Tom Pidcock in future.
Well, you've now done all the monuments, haven't you? You've now sort of covered all the monuments.
One way or the other, I've visited the Tour of Flanders a few years ago when Cancellara won. Man, it was cold. That was my least favourite experience, actually. And I've worked on all the rest. I was there at Liège-Bastogne-Liège when Dan Martin won and he beats Purito in the sprint to the line. I was there when I was there for that Cancellara Van Marker Paris-Roubaix victory, working again for ITV. This autumn and this spring, I was commentating for RCS at both Nibali's victories at Lombardia, which was a fabulous race. I really enjoyed that. Again, with a terrifying accident in it, and in Milan-San Remo. So I've one way or the other, I've ticked them all off, so lucky me. But they're great, aren't they? With the exception of Liège-Bastogne-Liège, which isn't.
What's wrong with Liège-Bastogne-Liège?
Well, it's boring, isn't it? It's really boring. It's just boring. And also, I struggle with the Ardennes Classics. I mean, I've done the one-day races now. I feel like when we get to the end of Paris-Roubaix, and I love even the Scale de Prize was great this year, wasn't it? There's so much to remember. But I'm done. And now I want to see the stage race. I want to see the Grand Tours. I'm kind of looking forward to that. And the Ardennes Classic, they're a bit formulaic. Everyone waits until that final climb, whether it's the Flèche Brabançon or Amstel Gold or the Flèche Wallonne. It all seems to be the same. And it's and in the end, Valverde wins.
Lovely countryside, though.
Yeah. But in the end, Valverde wins.
The Grand Tours are coming. The first one, of course, the Giro. There is a massive elephant in the room with the Giro, isn't there? And with every day that passes, you wonder whether the Giro is really going to start in Israel.
Well, I wondered briefly which elephant you were talking about. Because
come on to the skinny elephant
the skinny
later
elephant.
On.
I mean, we've just woken up to overnight news about Israel potentially being involved in the bombing of a Syrian airfield. Seems entirely plausible that they were. And this extraordinary ongoing story about the protests, and doesn't strike me as the right place to go now to take a bike race. Particularly because, from what I understand it, the money behind the Grand Départ in Israel and the people behind it don't seem entirely kind of open to the idea of making this a big statement of a peace gesture, if you like, and kind of like arms across the great divide. It doesn't strike me as a particularly... It strikes me as an Israeli thing, you know, with barely a nod to the other people who live in that part of the world. It just seems like a bad idea, actually, right now, in terms of security and in terms of politics all round. And I'm glad I'm not going. At one point, I thought I was going to be going, and I already had cold feet about it.
And probably too late to change now.
Well, it's 3 weeks now, isn't it? And knowing RCS, as I do, a little bit, I'm not entirely sure how cogent their contingency planning would have been. You know, they do in their struggle for survival financially, RCS, and let's face it, almost every block of race organisers have the same problem, face the same problems, with the possible exception of ASO. You know, they are easily attracted to the nearest person waving money around. Let's just put it like that, you know, and I get it. And I'm grateful in some ways that sometimes they do an uncomfortable, you know, I'm not entirely happy with their association with Abu Dhabi, for example, who don't have a great record in human rights. And yet, without that money, Tirreno Adriatico might not happen. You know, that's a race that loses money. It's not easy. They have my sympathies in that regard, but I think this might be one handshake too far. This having said that, I think it will happen, Ian, and I can only hope that when it does happen, that those colleagues of ours who go out there report the whole story, and I'm sure they will actually. And so maybe it'll be shedding light on a stalling peace process, and it needs a wider discussion. So if it's treated like that, then maybe a good thing, some good will come out of it.
As you said, there is another elephant in the room, a very skinny elephant in the room, Chris Froome. How long is that saga going to go on for?
Oh, well, far too long. I mean, this is the obvious answer to that. You've got to pick your words extremely carefully here. If you put yourself in his shoes, he is completely adamant that he, and I know this for a fact, right? So he is completely adamant that he has done nothing wrong. I don't know if he did anything wrong, Ian. You don't know if he did anything wrong. This process will probably never establish, actually, and that's the deep frustration, whether he has done anything wrong. He'll either be exonerated or sanctioned, and either way, it'll be unsatisfactory. But if you put yourself in his shoes, I know that he is completely convinced that, and for that reason, he has not been open to any plea bargaining. So he has put the blocks, every time it's mooted to him, you know, do you know what, Chris? You could stop racing now and you could start serving a voluntary suspension, which then might be backdated somehow, so that if you are given a six-month ban, you can kind of claim that you've served half of it already. And you know, he's not going to go there because he does not want to creep into that territory, which suggests that there's a scintilla of guilt in what he's done. He is desperate to prove that the testing process was at a kind of molecular, biological level, insufficiently reliable. Whether or not he can prove that, well, we're deep into realms that are way beyond you and me here, and way beyond Chris Froome, and probably way beyond his legal team, and certainly beyond the ken of WADA and the UCI, it strikes me. So no one knows, I don't think, quite how this test result happens. Chris Froome claims it was innocent, but rules are rules. There are precedents. The problem comes from the level of his own conviction and his reluctance to accept any shred of doubt about his propriety. And for that reason, his team are slowing this down, really, because they are going to go into as much detail as they possibly can and string this out for as long as they possibly can, I think.
And that reluctance to admit the possibility of any wrongdoing is in some way typical of Sky as well, isn't it? Which has not really helped their reputation.
Again, I'll go and pick my words very carefully here because we're in difficult territory here. But you're right. And you know, one of Chris Froome's problems is that he races in a white kit with a blue stripe down the middle. You know, it's been his blessing in many ways. The support he's received has given him the opportunity to do what he has done. But he is now, by association, in this whole much murkier in a way mix with the British cycling, UK anti-doping investigation, the Jiffy bag, the TUEs, which are not a matter of conjecture but fact, and unfortunately it's all bound up in that. And yeah, you're right, Sky have an incredibly bullish attitude, which I find at times almost admirable but also slightly inexplicable. I mean, it's still a mystery to me why the money men at Sky, at B Sky B, haven't kind of like seriously thought about or contemplated or gone near to pulling the plug on that team, because I don't see, in PR terms, I simply don't see what they have left to gain. They've won the Tour de France, what is it, five times now. That's their payback. And now it just strikes me that from a brand point of view, unless they can turn this around extremely fast, and I don't see how, I don't get what PR benefit they're deriving from the team any longer. So they are being, in a way, if you like, admirably loyal. You know, kind of perplexingly loyal. It's the way they do things, Ian. It's they are not going to budge an inch.
Away from all those problems, though, good season of racing ahead, we hope.
Yeah, it's very hard to move away from those problems. I mean, I can see that, I can hear the scepticism in your question. By the way, you know, let's forget about whether or not he Froome will race the Giro or come to the Tour, which is a whole other political can of worms. You know, from what I've seen, he is in a very remote place in terms of his form. You know, we've never seen him this bad. Well, he's got no results whatsoever to look at so far in 2018, and the Giro's 3 weeks away now. Listen, he's Chris Froome, isn't he? So there's every chance that he can get to the Giro and win it by 2.5 minutes. We've not seen evidence that he's in good enough shape to do that, but there's every chance he'll turn up. But that's an interesting that's an interesting kind of side story, isn't it? Because in the midst of all of this, he doesn't seem to be the rider that he was. And let's not forget, and it's always worth stressing that his last, I think I've got this right, his last three Grand Tour victories, the Vuelta and the last two Tours, have not, in none of those three races has he taken time out of his major rivals in summit finishes. Not once. He's not ridden away from them. That's three Grand Tours in succession. So he's banked everything on his time trialing form. And I think it's probably a harder thing to do at the Giro d'Italia than it is in the Tour de France.
Well, thanks for joining us, Ned.
Pleasure.
After Paris-Roubaix had finished, just before the awful news, I managed to speak to Fabian Cancellara to get his views on the race and the winner. Bizarrely, he was in Utah, accompanied by Rouleur's Stuart Clapp, but that's a story for another time.
At the moment, Paris-Roubaix is happening. I'm watching Paris-Roubaix in Utah when I could have got to Lille from my house in a couple of hours.
Is there a reason you're watching Paris-Roubaix in Utah rather than on Eurosport in Lyon C?
Yes, there is. A couple of weeks back, we got an email from the guys at Gore saying, do I want to come over to Utah to go riding in Park City with Fabian Cancellara and then watch Paris-Roubaix with him this morning, which I've just been doing. Fabian has just been talking us through the race, actually. He knows quite a lot about it.
Surprising that, given he won three times.
You know, it's like, he has the race, like the parkour was like burnt into his retina or something. He knows what's coming up next. And yeah, it's good. You know, he's like, yeah, it was. So yeah, we're here with Gore. They're launching some new bits and pieces and flew us out to go and hang out in Utah, which is an incredible place.
I don't suppose there's any chance you could pop back in and get Fabian on the phone, could you?
Yes, I'll go and get him. I'll call him. Fabian!
Fabian, hello.
Hello, Ian.
Well, that was a pretty good race, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was quite interesting. And also the words to the end from Peter, the way the race came, the way he came to his hands. I mean, we have seen he was relaxed compared to the other teams. When we see the defensive, the offensive way, been few teams racing, and he did one move, and there was the good one, the right one, and then he found a strong Swiss horse in the front that keep on going, and it's actually he's a deserved winner and an amazing second place for Sylvain Dillier. Because of being 220 kilometers in the break and being up there, I mean, chapeau.
When Sagan went with more than 50 kilometers to go, did you think he was going to get away with it?
Yes and no. I mean, at the moment where he went, there was anyway this the situation of like nothing was clear, nothing was really like what will come, what will be the next step, the next kilometers. I mean, it was this. Just he came out from the nothing and then boom. And I think this is also what he mentioned a bit. I mean, he had no bad luck. And we saw before a bit the jumping around and the attacks and the small trying getting away from other riders, other teams, but nothing really things worked out. I mean, Quickstep had Stibar and Gilbert in the front by themselves twice. I mean, I don't know why. And then, I mean, they tried to put pressure on, but on the other hand, it didn't work out. So, yeah, of course, it's always a long way. But I think when we have seen, he has made the major gap, and then the gap has stayed for that time until the finish line.
And Sagan looks so relaxed on the cobbles compared to a lot of other people.
Yeah, but I think also, I mean, this is also the type of style or even that, I mean, people been on fatigue, people been tired. I mean, you saw on the back, there been six riders pulling, but no one could close the gap to him. I mean, this is also shown as of a super condition he had. And, I mean, he was one of the favorite, but he wasn't the main favorite. And of course, also this can help you or can give you also a relaxed way to work on.
Because so many people thought that Sagan couldn't survive without a strong team like Quickstep or one of the other strong squads.
No, but today it has changed. Today things has worked for him. If he was alone in the front, I don't know if he could arrive by himself. But I think this is also not the case now. Because he won, and the way he won, congratulations. I mean, it's always, and he wanted to have a win. I mean, that's also clear. But we have seen also with the Belgians, probably the Belgians been fighting against each other. But still, the race had different places where it was half decisions came up. I mean, there was two crashes, there was a few punctures, a few critical moments. Where things has changed, but that's bicycle. That's the bicycle professional sport. I mean, it's nothing has to be perfect. I mean, this is the drama that is part of the game, is part of being professional bike rider.
And you mentioned him before, but a tremendous ride by Sylvain Dillier. You must have been cheering him on.
Yeah, of course. I mean, first he's Swiss. I know him. I spoke with him a few days ago. We've been texting to each other. He asked me a few advices, and but on the end, he has made a major amazing ride. I mean, 220 kilometers in the break, and then being up there. I mean, this doesn't happen so much, but I think, it's so nice to see Swiss guy up there. And amongst the big ones, I mean, amongst the favourites.
And when you were watching today, was there any sense that you'd rather be there on a bike rather than watching from Utah?
No, I mean, I'm fine with that. I mean, I know my situation. I mean, I'm more than happy. I mean, I'm retired in 2016. And since that, I mean, I have my freedom. I have my freedom because I don't have any lack of, I want to be back. I want to be there. I want to race. I'm quite busy, but in a good way. I'm learning in many directions. I'm learning in many new experiences that I'm putting in, because this is the second chapter I'm going into. I mean, I did 16 years professional and just standing still and wasting the time at home and looking out on the mirror and let's have a nice bike ride because it's nice weather. Nah, that's nothing. I mean, that's too bored to sit around and doing nothing. I mean, I'm young, I'm motivated, I learned so many things, and I want to put experience on the road. That's why also we're chasing Cancellara, to give experience to people, to have fun, to enjoy, to challenging each other, and to open new events for the community. I think this is important because the bicycle has a huge potential on so many different ways, and that's why I love it, and I'm motivated in the directions I'm doing it.
Fabien Cancellara, it's a pleasure to talk to you again. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Fabien Cancellara. At one point there, I thought I was going to have to fade him out like we do with Stuart Clapp, but he stopped just in time. That's nearly it for this edition. Earlier, Ned Bolting said Tom Pidcock might be the first British winner of Paris-Roubaix, if, of course, you exclude Magnus Bakstedt, which you really should. But there's another name now to add to the mix. 16-year-old Lewis Askey won the junior version of the race this year, the second British victory in a row over the cobbles. Ruler's Ian Cleverley caught up with him after the finish.
Lewis Askey, Paris-Roubaix winner, how does that sound?
Unbelievable, a bit mental, so yeah.
Did you fancy your chances this morning?
If I'm honest, I always fancy my chances. I don't think you can go into a race not believing you can win. So yeah, it's a race that definitely I've always looked, watched since I've been like however little, and a race that I've always thought could suit me down to the ground. So to come into that velodrome with just one other person and be able to out-sprint it in front of all these people was crazy.
Have you ever even raced on cobbles like that before?
No, never. The only time I've got close to that is just the racing I've done this year at Cairn and Ghent Wevelgem. So, and they're the only two races I've done this year. So.
I was just talking to Stuart, team boss, just now, and he was filling me in a little bit. You're from Lichfield, done a bit of everything. Cross skills come in handy today?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, definitely. I think especially on that one sector, it was a little bit wet, and staying on your bike there was crucial because it rained before the start quite heavily, and we were expecting a lot wetter than it was. But we hit the first few sectors and it was pretty dry because I think the sun came out, and it's been quite a hot day. I was sweating like mad over the cobbles, so it was just the one sector really that was really, really wet. And the cross skills and everything, mountain bike, bit of track at the end, I think it all comes down, and this is what I love doing, just riding my bike really.
Nice one. Who are you going to give the flowers to?
My nan and granddad have come here to watch me, so if I can find them, then yeah.
Oh, wonderful. Well done, mate.
Thank you.
And that's it from this Ruler podcast. Thanks to our guests, Ned Bolting and Fabian Cancellara. If you are able to get out on your bike, take it easy, and maybe take some time to remember a young man who died doing what he loved. Catch you next time.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about it.
Coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.